Bhikkhu Bodhi writes in his Eightfold Path, the opening dialogue begins with this phrase, the way to the end of suffering. And he says, the search for a spiritual path is born out of suffering. It does not start with lights and ecstasy, but with hard tacks of pain, disappointment, and confusion. However, for suffering to give rise to a genuine spiritual search, it must amount to more than something passively received from without. It has to trigger an inner realization, a perception which pierces through the facile complacency of our usual encounter with the world, to glimpse the insecurity perpetually gaping underfoot. When this insight dawns, even if momentarily, it can precipitate a profound personal crisis. It overturns accustomed goals and values, mocks our routine preoccupations, and leaves old enjoyments stubbornly unsatisfying. At first, such changes are generally not welcome. We try to deny our vision and to try to smother our doubts. We struggle to drive away the discontent with new pursuits, but the flame of inquiry, once lit, continues to burn. And if we do not let ourselves be swept away by superficial readjustments or slouch back into a patched-up version of our natural optimism, eventually the original glimmering of insight will again flare up, again confronts us with our essential plight. It is precisely at this point, with all escape routes blocked, that we are ready to seek a way to bring our disquietude to an end. No longer can we continue to drift complacency through life, driven blindly by our hunger for sense pleasures and by the pressures of prevailing social norms. A deeper reality beckons us. We have heard the call of a more stable, more authentic happiness. And until we arrive at our destination, we cannot rest content. But it is just then when we find ourselves. I read that often. I really love that quote. Which brings me to what I want to speak about this evening, which is a talk I'm pretty sure I've never gave before. And the talk is Coming to Terms with Self. This big topic, I don't know, it's sort of the number one topic in my mind. Me. Ever since I can remember, I've always been there. With some concern, worry, fear. Something to point out. Someone mentioned what-ifing today. I was like, I'm a what-ifer. And if I'm not what-ifing, I'm if-only-ing, which is my other favorite thing to do. Only this, and what if that? And also in the Buddhist paradigm or Buddhist perspective, we hear a lot about this not self, no self business, which I usually don't teach it because I find it to be very problematic. Because I certainly feel like I have a self somewhere in here. There's a strong sense of there being a me. And so I don't think it's so important really so much whether we think that there's a self or a not self. But really the issue at hand is, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do? How is this idea, this feeling, this sense of a self, how is that going to play into whether or not we're happy or whether or not we're suffering? I think that's the most important question, is what is it that we're going to do about it? So we have to get away from this paradigm of sort of who and why. When it comes to self, I think who and why are dangerous questions. Who am I and why am I here? I have gotten very little out of those questions. But I think it's a matter of how am I and what am I going to do about it? I think when we approach our self, our sense of self, we really want to look at it through the lens of how am I and what is it that I'm going to do about it? And I've made a lot of progress with those two questions, for the better. How am I? What am I going to do about it? Eden was visiting us a couple weeks ago in Colorado, and she gave me a copy of her book, which I've been reading, so I want to make a plug for her book, Relational Mindfulness, because I'm really enjoying it. And as somebody who reads endless Dharma books, I was so happy at the personal reflection in the book. And it really actually inspired me to talk about this, because I think really when we look at ourselves, we're best served if we think of it as a relationship. What is the relationship that I have with myself? Very complicated relationship, it turns out. A lot of history, a lot of disappointment, a lot of betrayal, a lot of joy, a lot of success, a lot of everything. And so I really want to just kind of offer a series of different ways to work with this as we're talking about the practice and doing a lot of emphasis on compassion here this week. I think it's good if we have some framework for how is it that we experience ourselves, what is the relationship we have to ourselves, and really what is the best we can expect out of this relationship. And so one of my teachers, Sayadaw Tejaniya, who is a Burmese monk, always says, the mind isn't yours, but you're responsible to take care of it. And I feel that way about myself. I don't own myself. I may not be myself. There may not even be a self. But whatever it is my responsibility to take care of it. Right? And so how do we go about that? And so I think when we look at whether there's a self or there's a not self, I always find it best to look at it through the lens of a gestalt picture. You know, this gestalt picture where if you look at it, it looks like two heads coming together. And then if you kind of tweak your eyes a little bit, it looks like two candlesticks. So when you look at it, you're like, well, is it two candlesticks? Or is it two faces? And so it's like, is it a self or is it a not self? And I think it's really a both and thing. So there are certain situations in my life where having an authentic sense of self serves me very well. So sometimes the candlestick frame works really good. But I can give you countless examples of situations and scenarios in my life where the sense of self is not very helpful. And then I have the two faces. And so I think that we're constantly framing it up and putting it down, framing it up and putting it down. And we want to stay out of this, who am I and why am I here? And more honest and authentic and transparent. Eden mentioned this today about this mirror. You know, mindfulness is a practice. Dharma just, in its perfect form, is just a really accurate mirror. And it just reflects back what's going on. It just is a reflection back of who and what we are. And, you know, hopefully some options on what we can do about that. And so I want to talk a little bit. I think one of the things that's helpful for me is to think of sort of the mind and the self as kind of operating in the same way. Because my mind is pretty convinced that it is itself. I have a hard time talking out of that. No, it's me, it's you. You did it again. Why do you always do that? Right? So my mind thinks that it is itself. But our mind isn't this. This is also too one thing I love about the neuroscience, about this neuroplasticity. The mind isn't like this kind of horrible contraption somewhere behind the eyes that kind of just, it's not fixed. Right? The operating system, we didn't just inherit this kind of junky contraption and we're kind of stuck with it and we kind of just go through life hoping it works out. Sometimes I feel that way. But actually the mind and the self, they're not things that exist actually, but they're events that occur. And so at every single moment the mind arises and passes away and arises and passes away, and we use that language a lot, right? Rising, passing away. And what rises with the mind much of the time is me. It's a long-standing theme in which I have a whole range of relationships with. And so I want to talk about sort of when the Buddha talks about the mind, he talks about it in these sort of these five aggregates. There's five ways in which we're convinced that we're us. And the first one is the body. In the body, I feel like I am the I'm the occupant. Right? And in the body, that's the role I play, is I occupy the body. And as I move through the world, wherever I go, I'm in the center. The world, I feel like, organizes itself around me. And I'm this occupant of five physical senses, of sights, of colors. So that's one of the strong senses that I get, is that I'm an occupant of this body. And that's that first aggregate, the forms, right? And then we have this other aspect of our experience, feelings. And I feel like I'm the beneficiary of the feelings. Right? I inherit. I'm the beneficiary of all the pain, of all the pleasure. And to somehow I feel like I am at fault for my feeling. If I feel pleasant, I like myself. I like this Dave Smith guy, he makes me feel good. If I feel unpleasant, I don't like this guy so much. And so at every moment I'm constantly inheriting, and I'm the beneficiary of these feelings, which is constantly giving me a sense of it being somehow mine. That's only 2 out of 5. 3, I have these perceptions. So now not only am I the occupant and the beneficiary, but I'm also the narrator. I'm the writer, I'm the artist. I'm the one constantly writing and rewriting and editing and copying and pasting and omitting and denying and justifying and what-ifing and if-only. It's like I have a pencil in one hand and an eraser in the other. And every other moment I'm doing, that's what I'm doing. Trying to come up with the right version of me that I can cling to and that I can present to the world that everybody will like. And it's a very tiresome endeavor. I'm the one who knows. Right? So I'm the occupant, I'm the beneficiary, I'm the narrator, I'm also the agent. I'm the one who makes choices, I'm the one who enacts those choices, and I'm the one who inherits the consequence of that choice. And so this part of my system, these impulses, these inclinations, these choices, I feel like I'm making them, I'm the one who's enacting them, and so this is one of the systems in my mind body that's constantly telling me that it's me. No, you did it. This is what happened. You shouldn't have done it. Why'd you do it? And it's like, well, I did it because you told me to do it. And then all of this arises in this ongoing consciousness of I feel like that there's some sort of essence to me that's me. That's, I can't find it, right? I can't pin it down. Am I my thumb? Am I my toenail? Am I my past? Am I my mother's son? Am I an American? Which one of the things is me? None of them are actually me. They're just all contributing factors that play into that ongoing sense. And of course, these assumptions are natural and really unavoidable. How could it be any other way? So we got to be careful that we don't try to turn our practice or our Buddhism or some of the philosophy in the framework. And this is really, I think, the nature of a spiritual bypass. Somehow I actually want to be above all everything I just explained to you, as if that were possible. I'm not that. But I am, I actually want to, it's not that I'm trying to get above that, I'm actually trying to embody that, to fully embody that in a very real and authentic way. And really I think much of the practice is not coming to terms with a Buddhist practice, but coming to terms with your humanity and being very realistic about the limitations and the possibilities. And both seem to be fairly endless, actually. But I think we can get hung up on our limitations and forget or not acknowledge, not be hopeful, not be optimistic about the possibilities. What are the possibilities? How good could it get? How good can it actually be in here? That's one thing I love about Eastern thought, is I'm assuming most of you grew up in American culture like I did, where we are so interested in what's wrong with us. And as a culture and a society, we're so interested in how bad people do and why people do bad, and we pathologize, and we have DSM-5, we have manuals on disorders, and that's really kind of what we spend our time looking at. How screwed up are you? And Eastern thought, and certainly the Buddhist tradition, is not so much interested in that. They're very interested in how good can people do. What are the qualities? What are the possibilities of the human experience? How do we unlock them? How do we cultivate them? How do we become them? How do we have compassion for ourselves? How do we have gratitude for our life? How do we cultivate awareness that's useful? Those are interesting questions. How do you do that? Right? And so some of us find ourselves kind of waking up to all this stuff. And so we come into a room like this, or we come into practice, and we've inherited just a boatload of conditioning. And then we kind of wake up to this maybe possibility of there being some other way. And I find that much of our practice, much of my life and practice, I find myself constantly in the middle of that. So no wonder I'm confused at times. No wonder I feel doubt at times. And so, and all of this contributes to this ongoing sense of there being a me, there being a self. And I can say for sure, with direct examples, that I much prefer being in here than I did at one point in my life. Being in here has actually gotten much better. Much better. And ironically, being in here has gotten much better, and my attitude, my experience of the world has greatly improved. I don't think the world has improved a whole lot in the last 15 or 20 years. But in my mind, it has. The world seems like a kinder, more forgiving, more compassionate, more wise place. Because actually, I don't want to go down this road, but actually, the theory is that we make the world with our mind. So if my mind improves, then the world has to improve. Because they're not, it's not like me and the world. It's this constant relationship in every single moment. It comes together, and it comes together, and it falls away, and it comes together. And we get whatever pieces we can out of that, and we make a story about the world is like this, and I'm like this, and this is how I am in the world, and the world is bad, and I'm good, or I'm good. And we're constantly, again, with the eraser and the pencil. You find yourself doing this from time to time? One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, uses this analogy that I really like, which makes it so hard in terms of the self being a kind of illusion. It's like if you aren't familiar with say you're not familiar with the Big Dipper, and we go outside, and I say, hey, there's the Big Dipper. What do you look? You look up and see a bunch of white dots in the sky. You're like, what, a Big Dipper? But if I go, no, see, like, there's these ones over here that look like a cup, and then there's this little handle that comes down, and then you go, oh, yeah, I see it. Oh, yeah, I get that. I can see why that's a Big Dipper. It's going to be hard to look up again at the sky and not see that Big Dipper, right? It's going to be hard to just see a bunch of white dots in the sky. And the self is very much like that. You've seen it so many times. You think it's hard to not see the Big Dipper, try not seeing you. try just experiencing like what we did in the woods, which I think is so beautiful to be able to like look at our experience through the sense doors, like smell and sound and sensation. It kind of helps that sense of self fall away. Not I am a person standing in a forest hearing a bird, but sound is arising. Sensation, the body is arising. I feel cool. There's coolness and warmth and a sense of ease and a sense of peace and a sense of not being separate from the trees and the birds, but actually being part of. And then that kind of internal reactivity, the clinging, the story, it kind of all slips away. It's like, why, I don't know if everybody does, but most people love watching the sunset. Right? That's where I love, where I live now. I live in rural Colorado, and like every day we have an epic sunset. You know, I'll be like, I'll tell my wife, I'm like, sometimes she'll be busy. I'm like, she's like, yeah, I love that beautiful pale new sunset. I have like, I got stuff to do. I'm like, no, it's really amazing. You got to see it. But it's like in that moment of watching the sun go down or being in nature or being in experience, that sense of self kind of falls away. We don't think to ourselves, I am a person watching a beautiful sunset. Or some people do. They do that and they have to pull out their phone and take a picture and post it and make a comment. Like, that's what the world has become, right? So self. I want everybody in the world to know that I enjoyed the sunset. But I actually didn't enjoy the sunset because I missed the whole thing. So we find moments like this. I find that I really like that. I like that. There's something about that notion or sense of self that falls away that's very comforting. And in that space, there comes an opportunity to sort of rebuild or reconstruct or reorganize the self, which I think is really much of the task here. If I have the eraser and the pencil, what the hell am I doing? Why don't I just write a fairly decent story of optimism and hope? And the thing is, it happens real slow. You know, it doesn't go as fast as we would like. Because this other thing I want to read about the self before I get into some of the early teachings on this. This comes from this book called Bangkok Tattoo. It's a really interesting book, and it's talking about the self. And it doesn't speak very highly of it, as you'll soon hear. And this comes from the pages of the book. You see, dear reader, speaking frankly without any intention to offend, you are a ramshackle collection of coincidences held together by a desperate and irrational clinging. There is no center at all. Everything depends on everything else. Your body depends on the environment. Your thoughts depend on whatever junk floats in from the media. Your emotions are largely the reptilian end of your DNA. Your intellect is a chemical computer that can't add up a zillionth as fast as a pocket calculator. And even your best side is a superficial piece of social programming that will fall apart just as soon as your spouse leaves with the kids and the money in the joint bank account, or the economy starts to fail and you get the sack, or you get constricted into some idiot's war, or they give you news about your brain tumor. Ouch. To name this amorphous morass of self-pity, vanity, and despair, self, is not only the height of hubris, it is also proof, if any were needed, that we are above all a delusional species. We are in a trance from birth to death. Prick the balloon, and what do you get? Emptiness. Take two steps in the divine art of Buddhist meditation, and you will find yourself on a planet you no longer recognize. Those needs and fears you thought were the very bones of your being turn out to be no more than bugs in your software. I don't know if that's supposed to inspire me or offend me, or maybe a little bit of both. So I don't know who the writer was, but I think that's a good plug to practice Dharma, I think. And so I want to talk about some of the ways in which the early teachings, the Buddha talks about how we come to terms and what is it that we can do about this self. And as you know, some of you know from the insight tradition, and in Buddhism, generally speaking in Buddhism, there tends to be lots of lists. So I'm going to stay away from the lists tonight and go with stories. Or oftentimes what we would call parables. So there's actually quite a lot of parable, especially in the earliest teachings in the canon. The Buddha tells a lot of stories, I think, because they didn't have written language, actually, and everything was memorized. So as much as it might be easy to memorize a list, it's probably actually easier to memorize a story, as long as you don't screw up the moral of the story, which happens. And so the first one I want to talk about, the Buddha talks about his awakening. And he talks about what happened to him, and I think he's really talking about what happens to us. And he talks about it in this parable of, it's called irrigating the field. And he talks about being a person living in a time and a place in a world of confusion, caught up in the material, social, just caught up. I don't know if you've ever been caught up in the world, but that kind of experience. And he talks about Dharma as practice, as when we sort of wake up, not that we have this full awakening, but we kind of understand that there's an internal world, right? We start to realize maybe the mind as the mind, or this, we start to realize that we're constructing something in here that we maybe have influence over. And he makes the analogy of waking up into a field. Actually, if you read further, he actually calls it a barren wasteland. So field sounds kind of nice, yeah. Barren wasteland. But it was interesting, when I bought my property in Colorado, we basically bought barren wasteland. But you could call it barren wasteland, or you could call it, you know, fresh earth, potential, water, sunlight, dirt, all of the ingredients to grow food, to raise animals, to build a home. So he talks about it as a two-part system of that, just awakening to this kind of open field, this barren wasteland, but there's lots of potential within it. There's sunlight, there's water. And so he talks about this in the sense of the first training of conceptually getting that. That sometimes when we come into practice, if we're not too caught up in what got us here, and we can kind of see this as a blank slate. And he talks about that through this teaching of irrigating the field, that what our job is to actually arrive into this open space, this open landscape, and begin to irrigate the field, to figure out how to get the water in, to figure out what types of seeds to plant, to figure out what types of crops to grow, to figure out when it's the good time to plant and the good time to harvest. And he comes at it very much with the lens of agriculture. Much of the teachings actually in the earliest canon are all about agriculture, and we have this word cultivation was the word that he used. Meditation is not in the Buddhist tradition so much. It's just how we talk about it in English. But he talks about cultivating, feed the fruit, cultivate awareness, cultivate compassion, cultivate kindness and generosity and patience and resolve and all of these, that you have that also on the software. You never opened it up, and it's probably buried in the applications folder that you've never looked at, but it's in there. Right? You just got to click on it and do the thing. So he talks about that in the sense of his awakening. He also has another parable, one of the ones that I really like that I've been studying and thinking about a lot, is this, what he called the parable of the raft, which is a very rich concept. And the idea of the raft is, as we move through the barren wasteland and move through this new experience. Sometimes we find ourselves coming to the edge. We come to, say, a river or a body of water that we have to get across. And that's a very, I think, poignant analogy for a lot of the things that we find in our life. We're going through our life, everything seems like it's going well, the irrigating, we're kind of doing some things, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, what is this? And he talks about how we have to find a way in and of ourselves to build a raft, to put together the sticks, to tie them together, and then we take the raft across the water, so we go from one shore on our journey across the water to another place. And a lot of times life is like that. If we think about the analogy of a raft, how many rafts have there been for you? You know, our parents sometimes provide a raft. I know that for me, I've been in recovery, and I've used AA as a raft, and I've used sponsors as a raft, and much of my Dharma practice has been a type of raft. Sometimes therapy can be a kind of raft. There are all ways in which we provide ourselves with a kind of tool and a practice that gets us from one point to another point. But one of the key points he makes is that when we get to the other side, we don't drag the raft around us. And otherwise, we all got like 15 rafts, and we're mad. That becomes a problem in itself, of itself. So a lot of times, something gets us from point A to point B, but we want to bring it with us. We don't want to abandon it or work it. We think that we need it to keep going. And this oftentimes happens with teachers. People get attached to their teachers. Or we get attached to friends. We get attached in relationships. And sometimes we forget that there's periods in our life where something was very useful and very meaningful for a period of time. And then we get to a point where we're like, oh, this isn't serving me anymore. And then again, we don't want to look at it and say, oh, that was a bad raft. That was a waste of time. That was no good. We can say, no, that was really an important time. That was an important experience I had. That was an important lesson. But I'm not going to carry it with me anymore. And a lot of these raft-like experiences are painful. Some of the best rafts that I've had were very unpleasant to be on. Very unpleasant. Some of the water that I had to traverse on those very dilapidated, not well put together rafts was very stormy. But I think it's important that we can use this parable, and the moral of the story is that often it's like that. Often the raft is like that. Right? And then we're back to that kind of, oh no, now I'm on the other side of the shore. And maybe I don't need a raft. Maybe I just need to keep walking. Right? Maybe I just need to keep walking. And that brings me to this. And so that's again, before I move on, that's that second kind of training. So in the Theravadin school, and actually a lot of schools of Buddhism, they talk about there being three kinds of wisdom. There's sort of the initial wisdom, which is the awakening of like, hey, there's something here. This practice, this perspective, this whatever. You've all had those, right? You read a book, you heard a talk, somebody said something to you, and something clicked. You're like, I think I'm going to go sit quietly in the woods by myself and follow my breath. You know, like not everybody gets that. Most people think you're crazy. You know? So we want to feel good and feel lucky and feel happy and feel grateful that we got ourselves in. And then the raft analogy is really that now we're starting to do some application. We're doing something. Stephen Batchelor writes here. He says, Dharma practice is founded on resolve. This is not an emotional conversation, a devastating realization of the error of your ways, a desperate urge to be good, but an ongoing heartfelt reflection on priorities, values, and purpose. It's not a devastating realization of the error of your ways, a desperate urge to be good, but an ongoing heartfelt reflection on priorities, values, and purpose. We need to keep taking stock of our lives in an unsentimental and uncompromising way. So that's the, what are we going to do about it? And we need to take stock of our lives, we can say ourselves. And there's always going to be another raft. There's always going to be another body of water to cross. It's not done yet. One of my teachers, Kamal Masters, who I got to sit with a couple months ago, talks about this when she makes a mistake or she gets in situations where she realizes she maybe was unskillful. She oftentimes will say to herself, well, my path isn't done yet. That's all. I'm not done. I'm just not done yet. We're all mid-journey. It's not going anywhere. Eden said that in The Walking, I think it's so great. It's like, we're not going anywhere. We're not trying to get anywhere. We're just doing our thing. We're doing this Dharma thing. A retreat can be a type of raft. And then this other parable that I really love the Buddha talks about is called the parable of the city. And he talks about it as if he has been on the journey, walking in the wilderness, and comes in contact with this ancient city. But it's a city that's in ruins. He talks about our practice coming that way. He talks about the practice in that way. He talks about ourself in that way. He talks about our inner life or ourself or our sense of purpose and our values to be something that needs to be renovated. And so there's an essence and a sense of, as we come into the city, we get a sense that there was once something here that was thriving, that was beautiful, that was important, that provided shelter. And he talks about coming into this city after being lost in the wilderness for some time. And the goal here is actually to renovate that city. And he talks about, he makes an analogy that the city is actually a metaphor for the Eightfold Path. And so he says, when you get to the city, here's eight things. Here's actually... So it's an analogy of a path wandering through the woods that leads to like another kind of path. Right? That's pretty well clearly laid out. And so when we think about practice, sometimes I find I work with a lot of people one-on-one, and I find that one of the things that's happened in our culture, because meditation and mindfulness and these things have gotten so much attention, which I think is great, is we forget that that meditation is one of three components, or really one of three of eight, depending how you want to crunch the numbers. Again, we're back to the list, so I'm going to try to put that aside for tonight. So meditation, it's not like we're trying to get good at meditating, right? We're not trying to, it's not a contest, as Eden said, right? It's just a kind of raft. Meditation is a kind of a raft. We cultivate this awareness so that way we can use that as a way to be careful and be wise about how we view the world, about the intentions that we bring, about the words that we say, about the actions that we take, about the work that we engage in our relationship to money. So really, everything. And the reason why I think the practice of mindfulness or awareness or whatever, however you hold it, there's many ways to talk about it. it can't really be reduced to an English word. But he even, one of the analogies that's made that's very much likened to this idea of a city is he talks about mindfulness is sort of is the guardian. And he talks about that what we do in practice is we actually, as if we've built a wall around the city. So the city is also a representation, not just for the Eightfold Path, but our whole internal sense of ease and presence and safety and the relationship that we have to ourselves. And that actually, the city is actually quite vulnerable from attack. As we go out into the world, I don't know about you, but my city is always getting robbed and burned down and stolen and all that stuff, right? And so mindfulness, he talks about it as being a guardian, guarding the senses. He talks about it in the sense of the sense doors, is mindfulness. We guard what we take in through the eyes. We guard what we take in through the ears, what we take in through the mind, what we take in through this. I wonder if the Buddha's teachings on cell phones would have been. I don't know about you, but my mind takes in a lot of garbage every single day. And a lot of it I willingly take in. You know? And so part of our practice, part of our discipline and our integrity is to be careful about how we live, what we take in. And so that's why I think sitting in these retreats and spending huge chunks of time, and you guys have been here on it, you guys have been practicing for a whole day. Most people will live their whole life and never spend one moment doing what you've spent a whole day doing. I think it's so easy to forget, you know, because we get tired and my leg hurts and myself shows up on the retreat. He goes, I don't know, man, like, this is what we're going to do with our vacation days? This is the best you could come up with? So you're just going to sit here and watch the breath? Cool. So you want me to just be quiet and leave you alone? Yeah, kind of. All right, well, hey, man, whatever you want to do, you know, for life. I hope the food's good. I hope. And there again, there it is, right? Mm-hmm. There it is. And again, we're not trying to get rid of it. But can we the word that means so much to me lately is cooperation. I have to cooperate with my mind, with myself, with my emotions, with the people around me. Otherwise, we become disconnected. Eden was talking about this. Just we cut off, right? We cut off all the time because we don't want to be with. It doesn't work, but we try really hard to cut off. And that creates a whole other range of issues. And so I want to talk about three skills and three ways I think that we can do this that I find brings me a lot of confidence and also brings me into my humanity more than into my sense of being Buddhist or someone who practices. And it's all actually really about letting go. And the one thing about letting go I find that has been so helpful is at first it's scary. I don't really want to do it. But I find that when it's done and when it happens, what comes out of that is a tremendous sense of ease and confidence. And so I find myself often in my life in this negotiated moment of like, knowing I need to let go of this, I need to let go of this, I need to let, I don't want to, it's scary, I don't want to do it. And I do it. And I feel really uncomfortable. And then eventually I feel resolved. I feel relieved. I feel ready to pick up the next thing that I don't want to let go of. Which is usually scheduled immediately. And so when we talk, one of the things that I want to mention too about this is this word that's somewhat problematic and has been problematic to me, this word refuge. Mm-hmm. And this idea that in Buddhist tradition we take refuge, we take refuge, and it's sort of like, if I take refuge in the thing, like the thing is going to protect me, right? Because oftentimes we associate refuge with a sense of protection or safety. In some sense, it seems like when I take refuge, it's like, oh, I'm a Buddhist now. I've taken refuge. I'm with the Buddhist people. They're going to take care of me. Right? I'm going to join that. Right? And so even in the early canon, Buddhism talks a lot about refuge, but the Buddha didn't talk so much about it. He talked about it more in the sense of it kind of being a raft. So, and also, it's not so much about taking refuge, it's actually about becoming a refuge. Becoming the safe and benevolent person. Becoming the understanding person. Becoming the generous person. Becoming a raft for somebody else. It's like, I got a raft, you want to go across? And you're like, yeah, I totally want to go across. Like, come on, man. I got room for you on my, and if not, I'll come back and get you, like, and then you become a raft. And it's like, that's really kind of more how it works in that sense of a calling out a mita, a spiritual friend, which is really how I hold what I do. It's like, I've been across the raft maybe more times than you. Maybe I have a nicer raft, or I actually have a raft, but I'm not a raft. I'm just lucky enough to have one. And so just this really idea of letting go of Buddha, right? This letting go of that. Letting go of the projection, letting go of the idea, letting go of the externalizing all of it onto whether it's a statue or it's a community or a group or a style of Buddhism. You know, there's a woman here actually named Tenzin, who's a Buddhist nun, who's part of my teacher training that I'm getting trained in CEB. I talked to her, she's like one of the most interesting people. I love her so much. But she's like, oh, I'm not interested in Tibetan Buddhism. She's like, the patriarchy and the misogyny. And she's like, and I'm a nun. I've got the red robes on and a shaved head. And she's like, I'm interested in the practices. And so she's interested in being like a raft. You know, and it's so interesting. I love it. That's the thing I love about our Gen X community, is it's just like none of us really are all that interested in all that stuff. We're interested in collaborating. And interested in saying, well, what do you think? Oh, gee, I don't hold it that way. That's not how I do it, but I like that. Yeah, let's do your thing. Like this really collaborative way of Dharma. It's about the Dharma. It's not about Buddhism or a kind of Buddhism. So kind of like letting go of that. And I find that when I let go of that, I have a hard time letting go of it. I pick it back up sometimes. I feel at ease and I feel confident. And the Buddha uses this word, I can never get the Pali right, not that it matters, but it means independent of others in the teachings. And he talks about it in a Jungian sense of what we start to have is sort of a dharmic individuation period where we've been practicing, we just sort of know for ourselves. This is how to do it. I practice kindness, we become individuated in our own dharmic sense. We don't have to take refuge in the Buddha. We don't have to externalize. We just know it. We become, and that word, that is splattered through the early canon. That the Buddha talks about, there's always a student and they practice and they get to a point where they become independent of others in the teachings. And they are either dependent. So we let go of that. We can let go of that. And also part of it would be letting go of the Dharma. Letting go of the raft. You know? These things that got us. They got us to a place now. We're at a new field. A new wasteland. We don't need to bring everything with us that we've learned. And then that's where we become dogmatic. You know, and I try hard not to do it, but I sometimes have found myself being on my Dharma, Buddhist high horse, and sort of trying to prescribe my dogma onto somebody else. Well, Buddhism says this, and you should do this, and you should do that. People don't typically enjoy being told what to do. and how your ism is better than their ism. That doesn't usually go well. Right? So how can we let go of that a little bit? Because it's very hard to pick up the new raft if you're hanging on to the old one. And it's scary too, because there's a sentimental aspect to it. The refuge there can be periods, people and places and things, and there's things in our life, people in our life, institute. There's a whole range of things in our life that are important, but they're probably a lot of things aren't going to be important all the way down the line, and it's hard to let go. It's hard to individuate out of these experiences into something new. But part of it is like we have to remember, we have to keep going. One of the things that's been so hard for me on the Dharma trail is that you actually find yourself having to let go of people. And the road gets narrower the longer you go. There's less and less people occupying it. But one thing that I've noticed that I really appreciate is I have the amount of people that I have relationships with become fewer and fewer, actually. But the quality of those relationships become better and better and better. Because I've had to let go, and I've had to move on, and I've had to look around me and say, who's here? Who made it? Who made it to this shore? It's like, oh, those guys are still back. Oh, bummer. Well, you're here. Let's keep going. And it's hard to do that. And I'm sure we could all think of countless examples of situations and experiences, whether it's a job or a friendship or a romantic relationship or a whole range of things. And it's not that those were bad or wrong or not good. They just don't serve us anymore. They just don't serve us anymore. And we have to let go of the raft. And the last one I want to talk about is letting go of Sangha, letting go of people. And Stephen Batchelor has this book that I really love, and one of the things I think that's helped me become independent of others in the teaching is actually we need to learn, I shouldn't say we need to learn, but we might want to consider learning, how is it that we learn to be alone with others? Which I love that analogy of like, we are alone. We do live in the privacy of our own mind. We do have, my experience and your experience have been very different. We're alone in our aggregate system. We're alone in our sense of self, and we really are, but we are with others. So learning how, this is why I think retreat and practice, because here you're practicing with yourself in a sense of solitude, in the sense of isolation. It can be very lonely, it can be very, very scary, it can be very, very challenging. But if I can be alone, I actually do much better with others if I can be alone. Because if I can't be alone, then when I get with others, I have a whole plethora of negotiations and expectations and assumptions and clinging, and manipulation, and a lot of implicit agreements. You're not going to leave me, right? We're good, right? That kind of fear of abandonment, of betrayal, of that. And a lot of times I found over the years, I'll stay in relationships, whether they're friends, teachers, romantic relationships, because even if it's not serving me, because I'm scared to be alone. I'd rather be in a group of people I don't care about so much than be alone by myself. Because the thing about all of this that's what makes it so hard, and it's the most obvious thing in the room that you hear about constantly, is impermanence. Things change. You change, your mind changes, the Dharma, your sense of Dharma changes, your practice changes, the raft changes, the water changes, people change. So we have to be willing to let go of these things in order so we can move on. So our self, our mind, our life, our experience, to me, those are all synonyms. It's a verb. Your life isn't a noun. You're not a noun. It's not a thing, a fixed thing. It's a process that we're constantly finding ourselves in engagement with. It's an ongoing, long-standing relationship. And so we can use all these different ideas and these practices and friends and teachers and a whole range of things, but I have found the thing that's so disappointing is, I'll find something that works and I'll assume it's going to work forever. I'm like, I'm good. Right? And it works until it doesn't. And then it goes through its own process of birth, old age, sickness, and death. And then change happens and we move on. So this practice, this self-awareness, self-compassion, Eden said it this morning, it's so important this afternoon, is it really has to, the old saying, charity has to start at home. It's where we really have to embody this sense of kindness and awareness and compassion and gratitude in here. And it flips everything on its head sometimes. So this is why I think it's so important to stay engaged, to stay curious. We're just not done yet. That's all. I'm not sure done is ever an event that occurs. So it's just an ongoing willingness to stay open, to stay curious, to stay involved. And one of the things I think that's so key is to stay hopeful and optimistic. That what you did, that this, whatever this is for you, it's going to lead you in the right direction. So this is what I offer for your reflection this evening. Maybe we just sit for a few minutes. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.